The first year I tried to describe the purpose of Lambeth, why we're so attracted to it, why is it such a central feature of so many yeshivas curriculums. And I tried to distinguish what the goal of Brisker Lambeth is. I just want to introduce or add a parable or an image that I think Brisker Lambeth can be compared to. Some people ask, well, if Brisker Lambeth is meant to build categories, and then to overlay those categories upon, as we say, the overlapping layers of the conversation, so that the Amoraim were discussing their machloks and surrounding these categories, and the Rishonim, and the Achronim, and multiple Rishonim. And that leads to something I described last week, the deauthoring of Lamdas. You're not only interested in stacking up the Ramban, you're interested in using these Rishonim to see which categories flow through the Talmudic debate. And you're looking at the situation from 10,000 feet up. I would compare that process to building a Lego. When you build Lego, so let's say you build this huge palace, and one wing of the palace or one extension of the Lego doesn't fit, or it breaks or something. Oh, we're locked in again. So if you break off that piece of Lego, come on in. If you break off that piece of Lego, then the structure itself doesn't collapse. You just break off that piece. So it could be something we were discussing last week. Let's say I've applied those categories to 7 or 8 different machloksin. Between Achronim, Rishonim, Tanayim, Amorayim, fundamental questions, secondary questions. And you come and say, well, I disagree with this application because this particular application to this particular Rishonim doesn't make sense to me. I think the machlokus has to do with something else. Okay, so just break off that piece of Lego and the rest of the Lego structure remains intact. Or, for example, let's say something we described last week. We come to a contradiction between two different Rambans. This Ramban suggests category A, and this Ramban suggests category B. So how do we solve the Ramban? Okay, so I'll say, you know what? That application, that second Ramban, has to do with this categorical machlokas. That application is wrong, and I'll break it off the Lego piece. But you're building a structure that has so many branches and wings to it that come from one common core that even if one branch or wing fails, the entire structure is still in place. So I use the metaphor of a Lego building, or if you want a submarine, if you're into the Army and Navy, if submarines are built as compartments, if let's say there's a leak in one compartment of the submarine, you shut down that compartment and the rest of the submarine, or the ships as well, the rest of the ship is safe. Whereas Pilpul, which is typically held out as the antithesis of Brisker Lambeth, Pilpul I would compare to a house of cards. Pilpul is typically, I've got the following problem to solve. If I say this, and I say this, and I say this, and I say this, and I say this, then I can solve whatever riddle I'm facing, whatever machlok is. If you take one of those ifs out of the house of cards, the entire house of cards collapse. Brisker is never a house of cards. If let's say you're introducing 4 or 5 overlapping machloksin, they're all standalone machloksin that stem from the constituent categories. There is a power and a compulsion. It's compelling just by the sheer volume of issues that you're associating. You know, any one particular issue, you can say, well, maybe that doesn't have to do with your category. Maybe it's another category. There's a whole different machloksin. Maybe you're wrong. But when you see them all stacked up, 5, 6, 7 machloksin, that all seem to be impacted by the same 2 categories, the same dichotomy of categories, that lends a certain compelling notion. Indeed, I've touched upon a very important category, something we discussed last week. Our goal is not necessarily to prove what the Ramban says, but to get to those categories through the treatment of the Rishonim. Okay. We talked about the goal. The goal is ultimately the classic sugya, not that there's any sugya that's classic, I warned you against this, is to have a makor and an ofi and hagdara. Where does the halacha come from? D'oraisa, d'rabbanan. How do we define the halacha known in the Torah world as geder? How do we define hagdir? And hagdara hagdara would be in Ravaran's terminology, nafkaminos, what the typical yeshiva world would call who, what, where, when, and how do we apply it. I'd like to start again last week, because I think last week I confused the goal and the process, and I want to make sure that they're separate. The goal is to get to those 3 parts of a sugya. Where does it come from? How do we define it? And what's the nafkaminas? Now, of course, part B and part A, part B and part C are cross-pollinating. On the one hand, you'll use the nafkaminas to try to induce the categories, and then once you know the categories, you'll deduce the nafkaminas. Induction means you develop a principle from details. Deduction means you take the principle and deduce other details, and you go back and forth. Once you have the category, you can imagine the details that will impact. But the Gemara doesn't present its categories. The Gemara presents its details, and you have to induce the categories from the dualities, the machloksin and havim and maskanas that we spoke about. Let's start again. Practically, you know where you're heading, what your agenda is, what you want to try to achieve, but how do you go through the steps of the sukkah? So I'll go quickly through what we described last week, and then we'll elaborate some of the latter steps of the sukkah we described. Read the Gemara. You want to be sensitive. I tried to make it a little fancier for you today. Three L's. Level, language, and layers. Level is deraisa derabanan, what level are we dealing with? Language, be very, very sensitive to the, not just the halachos that are being described, but the language the Gemara employs to describe those halachos, the kafadimayon, the brises, the limudim, another L. And then finally, layers. You could have multiple layers, obviously, between Tanaim and Amoraim, between the Mishnah and the Brisa, between discussions amongst the Amoraim, Lishnach, Ruina. Sometimes it's hard for people just to see that the Gemara isn't spoken in one voice, and just to say, oh, this is what the Gemara says initially, and then the Gemara introduces. And I try to put emphasis on that in the Shiur. When I give the Shiur, I say, okay, now comes along, now that we've reached that conclusion, all of a sudden, Rav introduces a branch or a new idea. So language, layers, and level. Level, language, and layers. Try to get to the base halacha. If it's a deraisa, which pasuk do we learn it from? Typically, the limudim will be in the Gemara. You want to consult with the medrash halacha, see how it's learned out in the Michalot and the Sifra. If it's a derabanan, what's the makor of the gzera? Where does it come from? If it's not even a derabanan, which, again, most of the time, I would say, depending on what you're learning, obviously, but probably, if I have to give a rough guesstimate, most of the sugyas and shas, however you define them, you're not dealing with something that comes from either a pasuk or specific gzera. It's just built into the logic of the halachic system. You know the system well enough. You know certain realities that are just embedded in the logic. So, Hamotz Mechav Elavar would be a perfect example where the Gemara searches for a makar and then says, you don't need a makar. It's just built into the fundamental way the system was orchestrated by Kodesh Baruch Hu, the same way Migo. The Gemara Ksivas tries to look for a specific makar for Migo, Lamali Krasavaru. So obviously in those cases, you sense the drama of looking for a makar or looking for a gzera and then just saying it's something that's like innate and instilled in the system. But even if it's not something that you can isolate, the baseline of the Rabbana, you want to just try to break it down because, as we said, every halacha tends to be an application. There's no halacha in Shas called Shlichas. And Shlichas happens to be Minayin L'Shlichas Minatara. But 99% of the time, you're not learning Shlichas, you're learning an application of Shlichas, a conditioning of Shlichas, a failure of Shlichas, and Shlichas Devar Avera. So really, in the background, you're learning Shlichas. You're not learning in Shlichas Devar Avera. You're really discussing concepts of Shlichas, which you're probing by trying to understand why it fails and how it fails and where it fails. So you can get lost in this Mekar Ofi Hagdara of Ein Shlichas Devar Avera. What's the Mekar of Ein Shlichas Devar Avera? There's a pasuk. What's the definition of Ein Shlichas Devar Avera? It fails for this reason, it fails for that reason. What's an afkamina? Where does it fail? Give all the afkaminas. Who, what, where, where, and how. But what you're really describing is a higher level of Shlichas. Right? Describing why Shlichas fails, you're essentially probing what are the keystones of Shlichas that fail for whatever reason in Ein Shlichas Devar Avera. So at least in the back of your mind, even if it's not in front of your mind, you have to know what the base is. And the base is, in this case, Shlichas. As I said last time, make sure before you start Rishonim, this is to me one of my pet peeves, you've got to really know the Gemara well. Rishonim just knew the Gemara so well, they're describing it with such ease and such facility and such a comfort level, that if you don't know the Gemara, most of the times, and boys come over to me and ask me questions and tell us they don't know the Gemara. And they're not following what Tosfos is saying. They have to go back to the Gemara and say, well, what is the Gemara? Oh, now you know what Tosfos is saying. And that provides the clarity. And at least in the beginning, if it's hard Gemaras, write a little outline, write a little table, especially there's a lot of machloks that come up in the Gemara. Don't be afraid to write these tables and to even, you know, even on your one note, to like put it at the top of your page. You can always reference it as you're writing out the sugya. And then just be sensitive to parallel Gemaras that come up. Look at the Masoras HaShas. Where else was this Gemara quoted? It was the exact same Gemara. That's pretty much where we left off last time. Now, you start reading Rishonim. Let's focus on how you read Rishonim today. Obviously, you start with Rashi. With Rashi, we're particularly sensitive. There aren't that many machloks in Rashi, per se. So in that sense, you don't have the same duality, the questions, the answers, which same phenomena you're facing in Tosfos, in the Ramban, Ritva, Rashba. But you are trying to distinguish between what Rashi says that's latent in the Gemara. He's just explaining the words of the Gemara, just to, as let's say, Art Squall would, and where he's editorializing and giving his opinion. Now, the difference between those two is not altogether clear. Many people, I think I've mentioned this to you in the past, one of the more famous shiur in the mirrors was given by a big Rosh Yeshiva named Rav Arieli. There are hundreds, if not thousands, of people that listen to that shiur. And most of the shiur is reading Rashi very, very carefully and being medayik every single word in Rashi. Our style is not to be that scrutinizing of Rashi, but I'll talk about hermeneutically going back to Rashi after you've built the sugya and trying to find certain ideas latent in Rashi. But certainly, there are certain Rashis that will stand out, maybe even tilt his hand and give you a particular halachic nafgamina, and not just say something stylistically that's overt, but he'll give a commitment to a particular halacha. And you want to make sure that you're sensitive to that, not just running through Rashi. But most of the real action in a sugya is going to really start once you break into Tosfos. That's really where the lightning of the sugya is felt. And that was a real revolution in the 12th century, 13th century France. They really revolutionized. Again, given the overlapping layer assumption, we assume that Atanayim and Amarayim thought this way also, but they thought it and described it implicitly. And then when they started to lose their facility and intimacy and familiarity with the sugyos, so the Balei HaTosfos had to come to systematize it, the same way Reb Chaim had to come and reinstitutionalize the system by lending it words and methods, and but things which are instinctive don't have to be systematized or institutionalized. But Tosfos will typically, most Tosfos, there are two types of Tosfos. The smaller Tosfos, which we like, will be more like Rashi. They'll just give a running commentary, tilt their hand, what was the Havamina. The more engaged and therefore more prominent Tosfos are those that will typically compare and contrast at least two sugyos, sometimes three, four, and five sugyos. And you want to read these Tosfos. Be sensitive to two different forms of answers in Tosfos. And this is something I really hammered in the beginning of this year, to learn the difference between a distinction that Tosfos will draw between two sugyos, which is technical. Essentially, the details are different, and Tosfos will very often assume that the details are different by introducing an Okimdo. Okimdo basically says, you think the Gemaras are talking about the same case, that Gemara, or our Gemara, is talking about a totally different case. And he introduces details. Many people are off-put by that. What do you mean? Hakintos is just simply thrust details that don't exist in the Gemara. And I keep telling you, if you know Shas well enough, and the Gemara seems to be saying something illogically, you have to assume there's some information missing. The same way if I turn to Phil and say, he's a dog, you know that I like Phil, and I don't say invective, and I don't speak vulgar, so that must mean in a cool way. Even though in a literal way, dog would be a very insulting statement, but you know me well enough, so the same thing. If you're looking at two sugyas and those two sugyas clash, Tosfos says, I know Shas well enough that the Amoraim would never have said this, and they probably intended a detail that's different in this case, which everyone knew, and now I'm just restoring that detail being different, because the logic has to be more obvious. It can't be as preposterous. Now, of course, just because Tosfos makes it a kimta doesn't mean your job is finished. You want to ask, well, why are those details important? Remember what I used to say, well, your name starts with B and your name starts with P, but that's not an important difference, Ben and Phil. The important difference is you went to first, you went empty, whatever, something more deep, something more inherent. So just because you find a detail that distinguishes between two Gemaras, you want to then say, well, why should that detail matter? Well, if the halacha is defined so-and-so, then the detail is really significant. And by introducing that detail as a distinguishing factor, I can probably infer that Tosfos read the halacha based on the following geder or category. Whereas if I felt the category were defined B, then it shouldn't make a difference. So right off the bat, even though Tosfos is not describing two categories, he may be committing to a certain category by acknowledging that detail as being a significant discrepancy or differential between the two sugyos. So that's important. A lot of people, when they see a technical difference in Tosfos, a kimta, they roll their eyes and they shut down the lamdas. It's a very important lamdas moment because you want to know why that detail should be important. Of course, more juicy and more savory and more pregnant with meaning is when Tosfos actually distinguishes not between the details of the two sugyos he's quoted, but between the halachic areas. In this area, in Shabbos, next year on Shabbos, so that would be the psak by whatever halacha we're dealing with, but by Bishul Akum or by whatever, or by Shvias, so you're comparing Harisha. Oh, so how do I define the Issa Harisha on Shabbos? How do I define the Issa Harisha on Shemitah? How do I define Shlichas Baget? How do I define Shlichas Memamon? How do I define Nechveis? What are we talking about? Mitzvah Baba Vera Dalaminim? How do I define Mitzvah? How do I define Baltosif in this case? How do I define Baltosif in this case? Just trying to think of some of the subjects you're probably learning. And that's really classic Brisker setup. Where it tells us it's mechalik in Hebrew, as Avraham would always tell us, not between the mitzias, but between the tchumen, between the halachic area. And why should those tchumen be different? Because this area of halacha is defined by the following logic, the following category. This area is defined by the following categories. And then you've got your categories. Well, defined. I guess I should probably take a step back. All this, I think, is contingent on a tool that you really have to train yourself, and you have trained yourself, to say it in common parlance, not to be lazy minds. What happens is, especially when you first start learning, is just to process what the Rishonim are saying takes so much investment and so much energy that your typical response when you finally understand what a Tosfos is saying is you congratulate yourself and you move on. And that's really the first step. Congratulate yourself and then be assertive and say, well, why would I say it? Why would I not say it? What does this imply? What does this assume? The fact that I understood tells us akimta as a differential between the two sikhas, but why would I accept that as irrelevant akimta? Why is that akimta relevant? Obviously because he defined the category. I remember very distinctly when I came to yeshiva, I had a very lazy mind. I was trained to have a lazy mind because most of my high school learning had been intake and memory. This one says such and such, this one says such and such, this one says such and such. I just memorized it. It was pretty good. It was pretty adept. I'd never been trained to be aggressive or assertive in challenging Rishonim, trying to identify these premises that the positions were based on, argue with the premise, not to argue with them, but to better understand the premise. Well, why would I say that if it's so likely to say something else? It's all back and forth. What's intuitive? Keep it smart for something that's less intuitive. And just train yourself. I was very conscious. One of the things I told myself when I was in Shenan, if I remember, is at the end of every day, I wanted to try to identify in my mind before I went to sleep what chiddush I came up with that day. These weren't groundbreaking chiddushim. These weren't things I'd write in my sefer. But just to be conscious and be mindful of trying to always have an assertive, active mind, not just to be happy that I've read the information, but to challenge the information and understand the information better. And again, those of you in the shiur earlier, you remember how dramatic I made it. Like I was fighting with Tosfos and battling with the Ritva. It was just to try to help you get that visual that you have to engage these ideas and challenge them, not to defeat them, but to better understand whatever embedded logic or category serves as a cornerstone of that position. Now, be sensitive to multiple Tosfos on a page. Don't ever assume that because they're all Tosfos, they're all consistent logic. These are just fragments that were recorded by Talmidim. This is one of the great periods of learning in Jewish history. Hundreds of Gedolei Hador congregated, creating some critical mass in France, led primarily by Rabbi Yaakov Ishtam. And this whole supernova that burst on the scene, the Baalei HaTosfos didn't write primarily. They didn't have time, wherewithal, resources to write their own chiddushim. Very similar, in a way, to what's happened over the last 100 years. It's a little bit of historiography, where when Rav Lichtenstein was honored 2 years before he was nifter with the Israel Prize, we had to scramble to put out a sefer. And people found it incongruous. Well, someone of his stature and his accomplishment, where is svarim? And because he spent his whole life at Talmidim, teaching. So we have reformulated the position of Rosh Hashiva into great teachers, not just great teachers, but people that are engaged with their Talmidim on a personal level. But the price we're paying is that we're really not publishers. I had this conversation a couple of days ago, so to speak, not really comparing and contrasting, but more or less we were comparing and contrasting Rabbi Sachs and Rabbi Lichtenstein. Obviously, they're not in the same field, and they're doing different things and different skill sets, but Rabbi Sachs is a prodigious publisher of his works, and Rav Aaron was not, because he spent them. To a degree, I was fascinated, because there were two levels of revelation to people after they processed Rabbi Lichtenstein through the eulogies and the whole big deal that emerged. For some, it was very low level. Like, they just imagined he was sitting in a room writing ideas all day. And they just saw the love and the relationships he had with people over the course of his life and the engagement he had with students. The second layer, which is more sophisticated, is he knew that he had relationships with students, but they thought those relationships were very cold and there was no emotion to them. And people realized there were deep emotions. They just weren't expressed in the typical conduits of emotion, charisma, and spirituality. They were expressed at deeper levels. So it was interesting to me as someone who is a relative insider to see how people process things that I took as a given, but to see it through their eyes. So that was really interesting to me that he had relationships with students, and that's his legacy, at the cost, so to speak, of him personally publishing his firm. With the Rav and the Briskers, it was different. There was a disinclination to publish because they didn't want to lock in the chiddushim and freeze them and fossilize them because they were always dynamic and they always wanted them to grow. But similarly, we have this phenomenon with Tosfos. So don't ever assume that two Tosfos in on the same page are consistent. And very often with Tosfos in, you'll have them relating to different stages of the Gemara. And that's also hard sometimes to follow which stage of the Gemara a particular Tosfos corresponds to. But oftentimes, even though they correspond to different stages, a subsequent Tosfos will circle back and make a statement that affects an earlier stage of the Gemara in ways that are very different than earlier Tosfosin recorded. So you have to be sensitive to that. Remember, we learned Ksuvos last year, right? Remember we learned last year?
Yeah.
Remember we got to Daf Yud Ches and all those Tosfosin on Daf Yud Ches? That's a classic example. We've got a lot of Tosfosin that fold in on each other. and say different things, not even in an abstract way. Well, if I abstract the logic of this telsis and abstract the logic of that telsis, I'll have contrary or conflicting logics. Even in the literal sense, they were just saying things that overlapped one another and contrasted with one another. So you want to be sensitive when you're reading telsis. Then, of course, the next sensitivity to telsis is something that I think you've started to appreciate this year. What did we learn this year? Right? See how telsis is hard. Telsis Haraj, Telsis Adain Peretz. Now you have, I'm not teaching Sukkot evidence, you have Telsis Adain Peretz, and you have Telsis Shans, you have Telsis Rid. The Telsis Rid really isn't a gloss to Telsis. Telsis Rid is a standalone, autonomous, it was part of that whole movement of Telsis in. But with the Telsis Adain Peretz and the Telsis Shans and the Telsis Haraj, essentially they're following almost Telsis by Telsis. You can see a card, oh, this is the Telsis Haraj on this Telsis. The language, the line of questioning is roughly similar with that range of similarity between 75% to 90%, similar and identical. But you want to try to find the differences between the Telsis Harash Rabbeinu Peretz and the Telsis Shans and Telsis. Those are very, very fruitful things to explore. We're essentially following along the same trail, but they're different trails, and I'll talk about this a little bit later. That's also fruitful in a different way, because it's a real clash. It's a real opposition. When you're all along the same trail, the Telsis Haraj makes a slight turn to the right because his language is a little different. It has a slightly different answer. I didn't see too much of this in the Chronon. I think Rav Aharon really conditioned us towards this, to reading Telsis Haraj and Telsis Adain Peretz and Telsis Shans, Telsis Yishanim carefully. Telsis Rid as well, but it's more of a standalone. I'll take apart the Sugya on his own. Kobe.
What exactly is, is this Telsis Haraj, Telsis Adain Peretz, they just have a different...
Their Talmidim actually sat down and consistently, methodically wrote their Telsis, and as opposed to all the other Balei Telsis, the Bein Hatam and the Ri and the Rivan, who just taught Talmidim, and then one or two generations later, the Talmidim wrote down their Kiddushim in a non-systematized organism.
Happens that all of their, 90% of what they said is exactly the same,
right?
Word for word,
right?
Okay.
Are you asking how did that happen historiographically?
I
don't know if there was communication between them, but they certainly were operating in the same Bate Medras, and at the very least, they heard the same conversations taking place. So even if they didn't compare and contrast their texts, that would be something to ask in a story and an academician. Even if the Rabbeinu Peretz never sat down with whoever wrote the Tosfos and said, what are you writing? I want to write the same. They both sat in front of the Rabbeim, and therefore their Chidushim were roughly similar. But obviously, the Rabbeinu Peretz either heard something different or felt something different on his own. That's a very, very fruitful way.
Does the Rosh keep his Perush in line with those for Rosh?
Yeah, more or less. Okay. More or less. Obviously, the Rosh is a Psak Sefer. It's intended as a Psak, so he's not going to quote all the opinions cited in the Telsis of Rosh, which he's a little more freehand because he's writing a commentary. But by and large, there's very few. It's not as if there's a different person writing the Telsis of Rosh. You can sense it's the same person. The Shittos are in line. They're very similar. Okay. The next stage, obviously, is to move from Tosfos to the Ramban, Ritva, Rashba. When you don't have them, you sense the absence. Even in Sukkah, where you have the Ramban, it isn't page by page, and you sense there's something absent, which is why Rav Lichtenstein was always very, very hesitant to feature Mesechtos that didn't have Ramban. He felt like there's something missing to the Sugya. Even Bava Kama, at least there's a Rashba. There's no Ramban, there's no Ritva, but at least there's a Rashba, which more or less plays the role of a Ramban. Im Sachin, the Rabbeinu David, his Talmud, more or less playing the role of the Ramban, not the Rashbam. Now, obviously, that's a little bit harder. As hard as Tosfos is, Tosfos isn't hard logically. Tosfos is just hard because it's poorly written grammatically. Dangling modifiers and shorthand. It's a poorly written sefer. It's not the way you and I would speak. It's not the way anyone would speak. It's a very different mode of communication. It's its own, almost like yeshivish. Like we have yeshivish language today. If you're not accustomed to it, you know what they're talking about. It was the Tosfos language that became very popular. Whereas the Ramban, the structure is clear. There's a question. There's an answer. There's an explanation. You don't have half sentences. You have dangling modifiers. The logic is a little bit more abstract and nuanced. So it's a little bit harder sometimes to read a Ramban, which is why I think you should feel free to read later renditions of the Ramban. What I mean is, if you're having a hard time with the Ramban, just read the Ritva. Because the Ritva was a little bit more clarifying than the Ramban was, for the same reason. It's always true that further on down the Masara, you're going to write a little clearer. So don't be afraid to say, oh, this is a hard Ramban. Let me read the Ritva. Let me read the Ran. Or, if push comes to shove, let me at least know what the Ramban is saying by seeing the Meiri or even seeing it in Achron, so at least I know what I'm reading. Now, you're compromising your objectivity and the freshness of the reading because you know what you're trying to find and you're not going to be as nuanced and as careful in the reading, but that's a worthwhile compromise to at least be able to establish beachhead and what the Ramban is saying. And then you'll try to alter it and, well, maybe the Meiri had a slight variation and a slight nuance in the Ramban that I'm not sure other Rishonim would adopt, but at least you can start operating in the Ramban. So don't be afraid to go further downstream and then start again further upstream. Not everyone's going to have the facility. And the same reason, I'll talk about this later, don't be afraid to read the Ramban selectively out of order to find the key core of the Ramban and then go back and read some of the questions that led up to the Ramban. In terms of the Rambam, as you saw in the Shir, I don't encourage reading the Rambam too extensively as part of building a sugya. Ban is very vague. You can make him say more or less whatever you want, which is why Briskers love reading the Rambam, because he's so organized. And because to understand what the Rambam meant about a category, it's typically combining four or five Rambams, and that's much more speculative. So in terms of the building blocks of Lamdas, and you remember, I didn't often, where there was a clear machlokas between the Rambam and the Ravid. So incidentally, it happened to be in the Rambam Ravid, but it could have been a machlokas between Tosis and the Ritva, could have been a machlokas Exos and the Ritva. There'd be a machlokas that started between the Rambam and the Ravid. But all of a sudden, just to say, let's see what the Rambam felt about the category. I don't think in the beginning. I think it's better to have those singles and doubles and triples, to use a baseball metaphor, and be adept at running the bases and all these basic skills before you start making fancy plays in the Rambam. But obviously, you want to just sometimes just understand what other Rishonim are saying by contrast. Oh, the Rambam says such and such about a sugya. Now I understand what the Ramban was talking about. He disagrees with the Rambam on this particular point. While you're reading Rishonim, and since Phil mentioned it before, you certainly, and I'll get to certain skills of reading Rishonim in a few minutes, you certainly want to be on the lookout and you want to be sensitive to extreme positions. Extreme positions are always valuable because they're logical smoking guns. Logic is always more obvious on the extremes when it's black and white. When you say something really preposterous, really radical, really, really extreme, oh, it's because he viewed the halacha such and such, and that's obvious. And then you want to say, okay, even if I don't take this extreme position, I adopt more moderate positions, can I still find that logic operating in other areas once I've seen it so clearly? That's true in any logical field, that the more extreme a position is, the more so. I mean, just to use something that's in the news now, if you want to see real racism and real xenophobia, you study Hitler or neo-Nazis in Europe or skinheads. And okay, now that we know what racism is, because we've seen it articulated so clearly, is Trump a racist? And if you look at Trump on his own, you may not make that comment, but now that you define it and see it more clearly, and I can see it in more subtle comments and more. That's always true in any logical assessment. The things that are more extreme, you can see the logic more clearly. I assembled a couple tips in terms of reading Rishonim. Let me give you some of these tips. Now that we've talked about reading Rashi, reading Tosfos, reading the Ramban, here are some tips about reading Rishonim. Number one, obviously try to compare something you've seen in the Ramban, something you've seen in Tosfos, something in Rashi. Right? Ultimately, the real way to achieve the categories and the nafkaminos is to, oh, there's a machlokas because about this halacha, Tosfos says such and such. The Ramban says such and such. They argue the machlokas is because they saw the categories as fundamentally different. That would be your best case scenario, where you identify Rishonim talking about the same issue, offering conflicting opinions. It's not always true. Very often, they're offset. There's an offset between the two. Sometimes that offset is only an adjusted offset, where essentially they're talking about the same issue, but they're dealing with it at a different layer. Tosfos is raising a primary question, and the Ramban is raising a secondary question, but they're still within the same field. So right now, the last sugya I learned, just because it's fresher in my mind, is Ein Bishul Achor Bishul. So Shabbos is the second Bishul you're not over from. Okay, now, there's one interesting question that by Blach, something which is a liquid, Yesh Bishul Achor Bishul, you are over on Shabbos, which is why we don't put soup back on the Blach, basically. Yesh Bishul Achor Bishul Blach. That's something which the Rosh, actually it's based on a Yireim, Yireim talks about it. And there's another question of Mitztamek Viralov. What happens if that second Bishul will be beneficial or the second Bishul will be counterproductive? So you can find Rishonim that are dealing with that issue of Bishul Achor Bishul B'davar Lach, but they're dealing with it at different layers. One is dealing with it at the top layer. Is there Bishul Achor Bishul B'lach? One is dealing with it at a lower layer, assuming this bishalach or bishal balach isn't only if the second bishal is mitzamek v'yafalo, beneficial, or even mitzamek v'ralo, where it's neutral or possibly even destructive. So essentially, they're still within that halacha, but they're attacking it from different layers, or different levels of the halacha, and you want to see, well, why would I say A, why would I say B, top layer, why would I say C, why would I say D on second layer? You can see that those two logics could be overlapping. So they might not always stack up as follows. They may stack up in different layers of the same halacha. Once you identify these machlokas, then you want to break down the machlokas, as I talked about last week, which is the intuitive position, which makes more sense, what's the one that makes less sense, how can I give a slur for it, then flip back to the one that seems to make intuitive sense, and then try to break down the machlokas until you get to two categories that explains the duality, why the Tosa says what he said, why the Rashba said what he said. More often than not, and this is hard to learn, but ultimately the goal of the sugya, is they'll be talking about totally different issues. Ramban will be talking about one question. Tosa will be talking about a different question. But you'll try to tether them to the same duality of categories. They're both probing whether we define shlichus, whether we define Baal Tosef, whether we define mitzvah baba vera, whether we define shir of aluvah, such and such. But Tosus applied it to this halachic application, nafkamina, and the Ramban applied it to a different nafkamina, but ultimately Tosus and the Ritva, even though they're talking about different fronts, they're talking about the same categories. And that's really where you see the power of lambdas. Remember in the shir where I tried to almost mesmerize, you see all these details that didn't seem in any way related. Then all of a sudden we found that unifying logic that affects this question and this question and this question and this question and this question. So just because you don't find Rishonim talking to each other, they're talking about totally separate details of the sugya, if you're able to link those specific conversations to categories, they're effectively talking to each other at the categorical level, even though they chose to describe different details or different applications of the subject. So just have that awareness, that game awareness. Are they talking about the same issue? Are they talking about the same issue at different levels of its application? Or are they talking about totally, totally different issues? And I've got to try to unite them by finding a similar logic. I said before, don't be afraid to selectively read. Sometimes, especially when you're first starting off, it's going to be very, very hard just to read a Ramban sequentially in its entirety. But you'll get a sense, oh, these are the three lines which Ramban makes his major, major thesis, major point. And even if I didn't fully follow what happened before, again, it's a bit of a risk. He may have said, in the sense you didn't read, what I'm about to say I disagree with him, but more often than not, he won't. You're not going to understand it fully, because obviously getting all the context and all the Gemaras that prodded him into that logic provide certain perspective that you'll be deficient of if you don't see the framework. But you can only do so much if you're going to read a Rishon. You know, keep in mind, people in many, many great yeshivas don't and certainly didn't read Rishonim. 150 years ago, no one read Rambans because they just weren't available. At most, you read a Shitim Mekubetzis quoting a short excerpt of the Ramban. All they had was Shitim Mekubetzis. But even people who had, and today, even people who have, very often you'll see them writing, I saw Mekilas Yaakov b'shem Ramban, I saw Mekitzos b'shem Ramban. So the fact that you're not able to read through the entire Ramban personally, independently, doesn't make you any less than the boy in Mir who's reading what the Ramban says because that expert. And we're hoping that by a personal reading of the Ramban, you'll internalize it more, you'll be able to excavate the logic, you'll maybe see a nuance in the Ramban. But don't feel frustrated if you can't read this whole Ramban, but you're able to hone in on the key part, especially if you have to know what you're looking for ahead of time because you've read the Ran or you've read the Akhlan that quotes him. But you certainly have what to gain from reading the Rishonim, but don't feel despairing if you're not able to read the Rishon as comprehensively as you'd like. And as I said before with the Gemara, it's even more true with the Rishonim. Write out what the Rishon says. Ramban says so-and-so about the following halacha. Tosa says that all of a sudden you'll see connections that your abstract mind wasn't able to link together. There's a lot of ideas flowing through your mind. And making things concrete creates visual and other forms of a palpability that allows you to see certain realities. It's just even, sometimes I'll just take a page and I'll just write on the page, different sectors of the page, machlokes in it are going on. And even when I develop structures, it takes a few runs sometimes to put the structure into place. And I can show you sugyas that I've mapped out and charted out. The initial page is very chaotic. I've got ideas and little circles and squares and arrows. and then my next run, I put them into an organized fashion. This is the first thing I think has to be discussed in the Sigur. Then I'll do it again. I can tell you that in terms of giving shir, now this is not about giving shir, this is more about study, but even giving shir, I spend far more time organizing the shir than actually learning it. What do I want to say? When do I want to say it? How do I want to say it? But even in terms of organizing your own clarity of the sugya, some people make the mistake, if I just read the next Rishon, I get more information, I'll get more clarity. In almost 99% of the cases, quite the contrary. By introducing more reading, you're just going to cloud what you've already. It pays just to lock in what you have, understand it as best as you can before you go on, if you go on, and just be satisfied with less information that you understand better. Another mistake I find, especially when boys get introduced to Lumdus, they'll find that one word in the Ramban or in Tosos and they'll assume, oh, that's because he defines it in so. Maisa, because after all, Rabbi, you talked this yesterday, whether it's a Maisa or a Chalos, and the Ramban says Maisa. Yeah, but the Ramban lived 800 years ago in Spain. And there's no way to know whether he used the word Maisa in the same way that I use the word Maisa, because many, 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 many of these terms are interchangeable. We can call them X and Y, which is we all agree that the word, the letter X is going to refer to Maisa, and the letter Y is going to refer to Chalos. We can start using X and Y. We can use black and blue. We can use any mutually agreed upon term. So obviously, these are not arbitrary, but they're fungible and flexible enough to mean different things. So just because he uses a term doesn't mean you should immediately assign him to that category. It's better to draw a conclusion from the whole body of work, the whole body. Oh, the Ramban says so-and-so, and his answer, and he could have answered this, but he didn't answer this because he felt the category was as such, and the other answer wouldn't have been tolerated or accommodated. And now seeing the entire context of the Ramban, that's why he uses the word Maisa as opposed to Chalos or something to be the equivalent. But don't just assume all of a sudden you find this one word and you're building an entire model around that word. Very often it's fallacious. Very often it's misleading. And then, of course, be sensitive to machloksin. Before you try to break down machloksin and find the categories which makes more sense and what's the other category, as a prelude to that, as a preface to that, is this a machlokus that's on technical grounds, but they're basically agreeing with the category, or it's a machlokus on fundamental grounds? And that's something I really tried to hammer into your condition for the first couple months. So the technical difference, was it a fundamental difference? So before you're off to the races and building categories, they're basically viewing Baltosif the same, but technically you apply this far or that far. So you always want to check yourself and say, is it a technical machlokus or is it a fundamental machlokus? Okay. Now we've read the Rishonim, we've read Rashi, you've built your categories. Take a few steps back, the following. Number one, summarize it. Okay? Just not in a organized, systemic model, I'll come later, but just try to always get that perspective. Don't mistake the trees for the forest and just, you know, or the wood for the tree. Or, okay, let me take back. What am I looking at here in a global sense? Which questions that the Rishonim dealt with were primary questions? Which questions were secondary questions? Which struck at the heart of the definition? Which were applications? I found my nafkaminos, right? Because those are the details from which I induced my categories. Oh, the Ramban talks about this nafkamina, this application, who is chayiv, how you're chayiv, when you're over, when you're not over, when you can have exclusion, how it affects this area. All the who, what, when, where, and how that we call nafkaminos, that are called hagdara. Try to associate nafkaminos. This is something that's a little bit more sophisticated, but very, very helpful in sharpening the nafkaminos. Remember I told you that every nafkamina essentially breaks down into one of two nafkaminos. You've got some chalk that to demonstrate. Again, it's never going to be this easy, but somehow in the background you should be sensitive to that. Is shlichus X or Y? Is shlichus just a maisa? The shlich does the maisa. The shlich is the baal hachalos. He becomes the mekadesh. He becomes the megarish. Here's something even easier to describe to you. Is hamotzi nechamera alav haraya? Is that an actual raya and a beror? Because I'm holding it, it's probably mine because I'm not a thief. Or it's just what I used to call status quo. You know, just leave it in your hands. Let sleeping dogs lie still until you bring sufficient evidence to change the reality. You know that it's your shirt, then in the absence of Mokir Balag Ma'amar, I don't know, but you keep the shirt until I can bring a Ma'amar Tzviach Levaroi. Now, you want to find cases, of course, and every Nafkamina by definition is, number one, cases of X. Call me out, Daniel. The union of X and Y. And I take formal logic, P's and Q's. You never take formal logic? Yeah, philosophy. I take formal logic. P's and Q's and U's and... Okay. X and not Y. That's a not Y sign. And the other one is Y and not X. Remember, if you want to try to prove what we have put down, if you want to try to prove what causes cancer, smoking or alcoholism. So what do you have to find? You have to find smokers who don't drink and drinkers who don't smoke. People who are completely abstinent are useless. People who drink and smoke, they're also useless. You'll never be able to tag it. So you smoke and you don't drink. Okay, let's check that population. You drink and you don't smoke. Let's check that population. So ultimately, that's what every nafkamina breaks down to. I want to try to find cases of where there's no bearer whatsoever. It's impossible to talk about a proof for whatever extenuating, mitigating circumstances, but the status quo is well and viable. And if it works and how it works, will show me how central the status quo will be in Mosmech HaVelavra. And then vice versa, cases where the status quo, like Arba, the ship on the sea, and the Imam Baba Basra, where there's no status quo, or if it's in Hefgar, but the Raya may be in force. So every Nafkamina, by definition, though this is, of course, very, very easy to say, it's harder to be able to associate them. But ultimately, you want to try to find what I call cousins. Nafkaminas that are cousins of each other. They share the same DNA, but a different DNA. That's my dream one day. You know, let's say I get fired in yeshiva. Someone gives me $1 million. That'd be my dream one day, to write a sefer, which is only this, basically going through segyos and showing nafkaminas that are inverses of one another. Because that's really the core of the segyot. Where you see nafkaminos that pull in different directions, that's different. But at least you want to have some sense of nafkaminos, or often to try to find nafkaminos that are all related. So let's say I ask, who could be motzi me with shofar? Say one nafkamina would be a katan, one nafkamina would be a chatzia b'chatzi ben charan, one nafkamina would be a cheresh. So even though they're each standalone nafkaminos, they all fall under the category of who as opposed to when. Remember, I think I gave you a shir last year on Mishloach Manos, how to define Mishloach Manos. And one of the Nafkaminas was, when do you give Mishloach Manos? That itself splintered into three Nafkaminas. Number one, if it's Kfarim, can you give it earlier in the villages? A Kippurim earlier, can you give Mishloach Manos? Number two is, if you're on Tesvav and you're Dalit, can you give on their off day? Number three, so these are all related because they all speak about the timing of the mitzvah, even though each of them has its own literature and its own machloks and its own application. But just try to cluster Nafkaminas. Ultimately, you'll see a sugya more clearly if you create clusters of nafkaminos rather than just individual. Do we have a chug now? You have a chug now? We'll stop in about 5-10 minutes. Okay. Finally, so now you've finished the sugya, you've read through the Rishonim, you've developed your nafkaminos, you've taken a few steps back. Hermeneutic reading means when you go back and read the beginning after you already know the end. So the classic hermeneutic reading is Megillas Esther. That's why you read it twice. We only appreciate Biktan Vateresh once we see Perek Vav and Mordechai is rescued because of his heroism. But I mean, we know the ending. But in theory, if you're reading it fresh, you don't know why that's introduced. And of course, in many more subtle points. And once you really read the end of Megillas Esther, you appreciate some of the subtleties that emerge in the beginning because it's all one intertwined plot. So that's a tool and a trope in general reading of text. It's called hermeneutic reading. It's very, very important in Gemara. Why? Because as I said, the further downstream you are, the clearer something is. So once you've read the Rishonim and perhaps the Acharonim, I'll talk about this in a few minutes, you've seen things clearer. Now go back and look at the Gemara. Oh, now that I've defined my categories by seeing Rishonim and Acharonim so clearly, now I know what Rabbi Akiva meant when he said this word, or what Abaye said when he meant this word, or when the Gemara applied this language to describe the halacha. Now it makes a lot more sense in ways that you couldn't earlier. So you do that with Acharonim and Rishonim, you can do it with Rishonim and Amoraim, Amoraim in theory and Tanaim as well. But always go back, and this is very good in Rashi also, because Rashi is just so shorthand, it's very difficult to see things clearly in Rashi, because he writes, but all of a sudden you develop your categories to a big, explosive machlokish in the Rambam and Tosfos, oh, that could be what Rashi meant when he said that word, or that could be what Rashi intended when he said that phrase. So always go back and take a final look at the sugya. A quick statement about Acharonim. Should you read Acharonim? First of all, there are two different types of Acharonim. One form, which is not really involved in building categories, that was the pre-Reb Chaim, the Pnei Yoshua's, and the Chassam Sofer's. I'm not grouping them together, but Svarim like that. I don't think at this point reading them with too much attention is going to be helpful. Obviously, you want to read everything, but you just have limited time, limited mind space. The other is Achronin that try to develop categories, either the classic earlier Achronin, let's say the Rebbe Chanan Wassermans, the Naftali Trups, and the Kilos Yaakovs, or today there are endless Svarim that are being published in Bnei Brak. Most of them are brisk orientation, and taking through. So again, to be honest, a lot of boys in yeshiva that don't have these tools, a lot of their learning is basically reading the Gemara, making a quick read through Rishonim, and reading a very nice sefer. These are the Svarim, the Dvar Moshe, or the Beit Lechem Yehuda, or the Birchas Avraham. These are all the Svarim that are very, very popular. When you walk into YU next year, Phil and Ben, you'll see these Svarim on every table. A lot of boys are actively reading this. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's the way they've been trained, or in the absence of being trained to make personal assessments of the sugya. Now, the good part about that is you get a ready-made sugya. Basically, these are great Talmidei Chachamim who have essentially performed this process for you. Just sit at the table and eat the cake without having to go through the baking process. The limitation of that is essentially you're sold on their approach to the sugya. You don't realize there's another way to approach the sugya. If you plan to be operating at the fundamental level of a sugya, so then reading them too quickly can bias you or prejudice you to their way of reading the sugya. Like at my stage already, I'm able to read them, but not be enslaved by them. So then I'm able to say, okay, that's a nice view of the sugya. In fact, I enjoy them because it helps me trigger new ways to read the sugya that I'm not able to come to on my own because I just know the Gemara better than me. Oh, I never noticed that. Why would I say it? Why would I not say it? And I'm right there. And developing patterns in the sugya. So I really enjoy reading those svarim, but I didn't read them when I was your age, and I didn't have the developed skills, and I would have essentially sold my mind to their mahalik. But there's nothing wrong with selling your mind to a good mahalik. If you're interested not in a mahalik, but mahalchim, then it can become a little bit limiting. And then finally, what I like to do, and I did last year, is once you feel that you've got a sugya fairly organized, then try to make a more formal rendition, either an outline or a table, because that will help you organize your thoughts, gain perspective, top level, second level, concepts. My favorite is, as you saw, that tree.